You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Indeed, it is starting now. Let's see if we can get through this hour with all buttons working as they should and phrasing coming out of my mouth as it should also. Let's just get straight into what's on the show. I mean, hello and welcome to The Wire. You're listening to me, Lillian Hanley. I'll be with you for the next hour. Let's hope. I mean, I don't know. I could turn my mic off or something and not be here. It is Thursday the 23rd of April and we have been under Dahui for 4 weeks officially. You can probably tell. What is on the show? I speak today with a Centre for Research Excellence Te Pūnaha Matatini Deputy Director Kate Hanna about their latest report on the inequity of the infection fatality rate of COVID-19. We will hear from Labour's Andrew Little once again. This week, Mary Margaret asked for his response to current debates about comparisons to Australia and whether or not we should return to normal. In quotation marks. Rachel brings us an update on the state of the states in regards to the latest oil prices hitting a major low. Mary Margaret also catches up with Radio Adelaide's Zoe Kunadas about the fate of Virgin Airlines, how much the public really cares about the pirating of Malcolm Turnbull's memoirs and a rogue kangaroo. We also have a chat with Tamati Kruger, chair of the Te Uruwera board, about how Tūhoe is responding to the Rahui. We were supposed to play this yesterday, but didn't have time. We'll see how we go today. Finally, we have our updates from the Epidemic Response Committee meeting, where today they are focusing on the future of business and entrepreneurship in New Zealand, with the need to develop contact tracing technology as a leading nation on a global scale. There is also an announcement from Chris Farfoy coming at 12:30 regarding the media. So let's hope we can get some information on that to you before the end of the show. Otherwise, remember you can text in 5395 or call 309-3879. Get in touch throughout the show. You can also catch these all these pieces and more in full on the 95BFM website after the show. Okay. We made it. Let's go.
Māori grievances about land are historical. We didn't wake up in the 1970s all angry and protesty and, you know, started demanding our things back.
The Wire. Kate Hanna is a cultural historian and also the Deputy Director of Te Pūnaha Matatini. This is a centre of research excellence based at the University of Auckland. The name means the meeting place of many faces. Their researchers are from a range of disciplines, all of whom are interested in understanding the links between things to use mathematically via networks to try and understand the world. A relationship-based way of doing science rather than a reductionist or positive way of doing it, says Kate. So those in social sciences and humanities work alongside highly computational researchers in order to contextualise the mathematics they present. This way of working has been important in their work on COVID-19, looking into the many experiences of racism for Māori and Pacifica peoples in Aotearoa, within the healthcare system and other governmental and social systems. Te Pūnaha Matatini released a report last week on health inequities relating to the infection fatality rate of COVID-19. It stated, the communities at the highest risk will be those with elderly populations and Māori and Pacifica communities where the compounded effects of underlying health conditions, socioeconomic disadvantage and structural racism result in imbricated risk of contracting COVID-19, becoming unwell and death. I spoke to Kate about this and started by asking about the IFR, or the infection fatality rate. Should we go to that report now? Do you want to just explain infection fatality rate?
Oh, goodness, that's a scary question to ask a cultural historian. So the infection fatality rate is a way of measuring how many people who become infected with COVID-19 are likely to die. Which is, you know, a relatively hard, poor thing to sort of think about and talk about. But we need to understand the ratio of fatalities to the rate of total infections so that we can plan for the burden on the healthcare system, so we can think about things like the levels that the New Zealand government currently has in place as a protective measure for containment and control of the disease. So we do need to understand how many people are likely to die if the disease progresses through our communities unchecked and unmanaged. And so what we've tried to do in this paper is understand the international data on base infection fatality rates in the context of what we know about the New Zealand healthcare system and systemic racism and health inequalities and inequities for Māori and for Pacific peoples.
What has this report found in terms of the IFR for Māori and Pacific communities?
So what we've done is we've used a couple of different other parameters to try and establish a context for what inequitable access to healthcare means. So that we're not just going, okay, so the infection fatality rate overseas for everybody is this, so that will be the same for Māori. And what we've done for these mathematical proxies is use, so what we know about life expectancy, so that Māori life expectancy is shorter. What we know about pre-existing conditions, so the numbers of Māori, and obviously in this paper too, by ethnicity, so Pacific peoples and others, experiences of comorbidities or pre-existing conditions that we know seem to exacerbate severity of infection of COVID-19. And then we've also tried to use a sort of metric around access to healthcare. So we've used quite a simple one here around unmet health needs. So that's a verbal report of whether you are able to go to the GP when you want to. There are lots of other different methodologies that we'd like to start exploring using, but this is just the first simple one. And what that has found is that if you look at the summary, that if we just count the underlying health conditions as being more important than age, the estimated fatality rate for Māori is about 2.5 times that of New Zealand European. But if age is the dominant factor, then the estimated infection fatality rate for Māori is around 50% higher than non-Māori. And we believe that these are probably fairly conservative estimations because, as I say, we've used some sort of relatively crude mathematical parameters to try and model that racism part. And so, you know, the summary being that the communities at highest risk will be those communities that have elderly populations and Māori and Pacific communities, and it's about the compounded or layered effects of underlying health conditions, socioeconomic disadvantage, and then structural racism. Mm. So as you layer those things on, that we believe that the likelihood of severe outcome is sort of increased significantly.
Right. When you say you've used those particular parameters, is that because there isn't enough up-to-date data pertaining to these particular communities? And also as part of that, is it because the kind of outbreak hasn't been in those communities so far?
So it's partly because we haven't seen significant outbreak, as you say, in those smaller, maybe rural regional communities with high numbers of elderly Māori, say, living in them. It's also to do with the quality of data, as you've really accurately pointed out, Lillian. So, the census failings from 2019 and 2018 have exacerbated the fact that we don't have good data for Māori. So we're having to use some other places to draw data from. And so obviously, one of the sort of hypotheticals or questions that we've been trying to think about when we're thinking about this model is, okay, so if you have a multi-generational family home with people who maybe are over 60, so because we're dropping the number of, reducing the number for the age risk for Māori and Pacific peoples because of that shorter life expectancy and the presence of comorbidities. So maybe you've got grandparents living there who are over 60. They normally provide really great family support for childcare and other things, so parents who are maybe essential workers can continue to work, in a level 4 or level 3 situation. And this is sort of the, I guess, what you were talking about with the one size fits all. How does that family unit continue to support each other but also keep each other well if some people are leaving the house to go and be essential workers, and other people are highly vulnerable, and there's children who might need to go to school. So it's about imagining what that looks like for those families.
This is not the first report that you guys are doing on COVID-19, or is it?
No, so this is not the first report. Yeah. This is the first published one that has taken into account the ethnicity data, the New Zealand ethnicity data.
Okay.
And future-facing reports that do modelling of, say, the epidemic spread, so those kind of exponential growth graphs that people have seen, that we're flattening the curve, that's what New Zealand's trying to do, will also start to incorporate these predictions around different sectors of the community, and also looking at regionality, because we know that different regions have different levels of access to healthcare for all people within that region, and then these are the exacerbated issues for those who experience healthcare inequities in terms of their access to healthcare.
Right, and so going back to the IFR, that would kind of, what you guys are looking at, that explains, I suppose, like what we are seeing, right, is a sort of much larger number of infections than we are deaths at this point.
Because of the type of containment that New Zealand is doing.
Okay, so even like on that level, there is this kind of blanket containment protocol or what we've chosen to do to respond to this. And so what this research is showing is that there is, even beyond that, the kind of risks that are waiting, I suppose, if there was to be more of an outbreak, or just simply certain people being infected.
Yeah. So what we've seen in New Zealand so far is that we're still very much contact tracing in clusters, and also from international travel. So thinking quickly back to yesterday's data, and also just holding up the families of the 14 people who have died in New Zealand from COVID-19, that yesterday's data was that there were 6 new cases, and I think 3 of them, from what I briefly read yesterday, 3 of them linked to international travel, I think to cruise ships, and then the 3 others are linked to clusters. So we largely know where COVID-19 is coming from, and therefore where it is likely to go at the moment, because of the kind of contact tracing and the shutdown that we've had. But if there was to be uncontrolled outbreaks, and I think, you know, the paper does go into that in the discussion, we would definitely see much higher impacts on Māori, Pacific peoples, people experiencing healthcare inequities, and other higher risk groups.
And this might seem like a silly question, but could you just explain the difference between equity and equality?
Equity and equality. So when we think about health inequities, we're thinking about not in a sort of fairness model. I think people will have seen, perhaps there's a picture that shows some different ages of people, so different heights, and they can't see through to a sports game because there's a barrier in the way. And so, you know, an equality kind of measure might be to give somebody a box to stand on so that they can see over the barrier. But a more equitable measure would be to simply remove the fence or barrier so that everybody has an equitable opportunity to see what they want to see, rather than having to use something to stand on. It's very hard to explain a visual image but hopefully that helps.
So some of the other research that's come through and criticising, I suppose, the fact that the government has made moves in a way that might seem a bit one size fits all, was the quote, in terms of their responses. Like, especially at the beginning, there was kind of less specific responses for specific communities who might have specific needs. And that is sort of an equal approach, right? You're sort of going through it saying, here, this is what we're going to do for everybody. Everyone has to stay home. Everybody has to do this. But in terms of what I'm seeing from this report, right, it shows obviously something that we already know, is that there are health inequities in some of our communities in this country. So kind of what would it be that we need in order to respond equitably to what we're facing, I suppose?
So I think one of the things, and there's been wonderful work by collectives of Māori public health physicians, and that will be some of the work that you're referring to around sort of the one-size-fits-all approach isn't going to work. So what we've been thinking about is how Māori and Pacific peoples and those experiencing health inequities and at-risk communities will have differential experiences all along the chain of COVID-19 impacts. So not just, I mean, this paper obviously looks at fatality, but if we think about the whole chain, Māori will have differential experiences of exposure, so the likelihood of being exposed to it because of the number of Māori who work in essential services on the front lines in places where they are likely to come into contact with other people, even at a level 4 or level 3 level of shutdown. Māori will also experience, we believe, a differential experience of infection. So that's also to do with historical context of other pandemics and epidemics have inequitably affected Māori. So we obviously have the kōrero around smallpox pandemic in 1913, where barriers were used to keep Māori out of Pākehā settlements in the Waikato. We know the immense impact that the 1918 flu pandemic had on Māori communities and in the Pacific, devastating communities, and there are stories still told now of mass graves and inability to have pāngihanga at that time. So all of those historical contexts mean that the concept or idea of infection is very traumatising, re-traumatising. It's part of a colonial process of trauma. And then Māori will experience different, have differential experiences of transmission, potentially. So that's one of the things we've tried to model for multi-family living or overcrowding. And then we know from things like Y2575 and other reports around racism in the health system, the Māori and Pacific peoples will have a differential experience of what it is like to be hospitalised, what it is like to be treated, access to primary health care. So all of that comes prior to even what we're discussing in this paper, which is the differential experience of fatality. The other thing that we do know, particularly from the historical experience of pandemics, is that Māori have always had regional, localised iwi, hapu and whānau-based responses to those traumas that have made communities and families and hapu and iwi resilient and helped them survive through these things. So, you know, that's the equitable solution, is giving funding and support to localised, regionalised responses that are appropriate for those communities. So, as I said, the paper can be relatively hard reading, and as it should be, it's, you know, it is it's there to tell a truth about our system, that there is, you know, huge unmet health need and underlying racism, which could really adversely affect those who are most vulnerable, but also that we have solutions in place. We have regional hapu, iwi and whānau strengths that can be supported by government funding to find solutions that are localised and suitable. And, you know, seeing things like the Homie collaboration with Food Chain, the food distribution company, which is a Māori-led initiative to get food to whānau in Kaumātua, you know, that kind of thing is thrilling, because that's the kind of solution that supports existing New Zealand business and supports Kaumātua and whānau to continue to be healthy and well without having to go to the supermarket to access food. You know, those kinds of things are possible.
That was Kate Hannah speaking about health inequities quite generally, and something we should keep in mind as we sort of head into the aftermath of this all, as well as currently right now. Back after this break with Andrew Little.
The Strokes, The New Abnormal, is out now. Their first full length in 7 years. Recorded in Malibu with the legendary Rick Rubin, The New Abnormal couldn't have come at a better time. The Strokes, The New Abnormal, out now wherever fine music is streamed. Add to your collection now.
Thanks a lot. Cheers.
Play some Chili.
I don't know if we...
Play some Slayer.
Play Slayer!
Do you want the single version or the album version?
Slayer!
Yeah, all right, hold your horses. Okay, this one's called Raining Blood.
One, two, three.
95BFM's Jukebox Parlour is taking all your requests. And we know you have requests. Jukebox Parlour with Soong. Saturday, 7 to 9pm, only on 95BFM. Thanks to Shosha, original specialists for e-cigarettes, vaping devices and more. Check out shosha.co.nz.
Now it's time for our weekly chat with Labour MP Andrew Little.
Comparing New Zealand's COVID-19 policy to Australia's has been a key part of the arguments posited by those who disagree with nationwide lockdown. For their last chat under Level 4, Mary Margaret asked Andrew about if we should be paying attention to how Australia combated the virus without a dāhui like ours. They also discussed mental health, if returning to, quote, normal is viable or not, and how long Level 3 might last for.
So let's start with how we're moving to alert level 3-4 and initial period of 2 weeks. Yeah. How long do you anticipate that it might last for?
Look, hopefully it'll last the 2 weeks. I think this is about just, you know, moving cautiously. The numbers are getting right down now. We're in single digits. The worst thing that could happen is that there's another outbreak somewhere. It gets uncontrolled and then we have to go back to level 4. So that's why we're taking the approach that we're taking. The lesson from all of this and from other countries is not to get too far ahead of ourselves too quickly.
Mm. Now, there has been a lot of debate about the necessity of a stringent lockdown, and a lot of it has come down to comparisons to Australia's approach. Do you think that more research should be done into why it is that Australia does have comparatively low transmission despite there not having been as widespread a lockdown?
Yeah, I think we probably just need a better picture of what is happening in Australia. Australia has done, in most states, pretty close to the kind of lockdown that we have done. They've been very, very constrained in what people can do. Might add to, on a population basis too, their numbers have been higher, their fatalities have been higher. And the other thing I'd point out too is, look, we're at the beginning of this. This has months to run because until there is a vaccine, then no one can say we're over this. So there will be constraints. And as we're seeing in other countries that only a matter of 3 or 4 weeks ago were held up as the great models of how to do this, are having second waves now. And you know, Singapore is one of them. You see what's happening in Sweden and some of those other Nordic countries too. The second wave is happening and then they haven't been ready for it.
Mm.
So let's save our comparisons, you know, for a few months yet,
yeah,
to see what happens. I think it's too premature to say Australia's done better than us. I just don't think we know what we're comparing at the moment.
Yeah. So another cause for discussion throughout Aotearoa has been the notion that we should take this opportunity to change instead of return to normal. And we do know that normal didn't work for many groups. How much can we expect this to influence Labor's policy from here on? Do you think we should be using this as an opportunity to change?
Well, I don't think we've got much choice about it. I think this has really exposed a lot of things that we do need to change. And one of those things is the level of inequality. You know, you look at how this just going into lockdown has affected different communities and people, you know, with different kind of levels of economic backing, so lower wage workers. Are really struggling. All the stories we're hearing now about food banks having a level of demand put on them, which is hundreds or many times greater than has been in the past. So this has exposed a few things. I think it's exposed some vulnerabilities about what we've been reliant on, tourism, for a huge amount. And of course, that has completely collapsed. So we do need to reorient the economy into things that means we are more resilient, but actually more people get a chance of getting a better deal. And this idea that we should trump it, as I think we have seen over many decades, that having a whole bunch of people on low incomes, or at least on incomes where they're literally living week to week or paycheck to paycheck, actually that's not good. That's not sustainable. And we've proved that in the last 4 weeks. People do need to have earn incomes where they can have a little bit put aside so they can deal with these difficult times. And so we've got to find a way of reorienting the economy so that the type of jobs that we have good jobs, well-paid jobs, give people that little bit extra. We should not aspire to be a poor country or even a middling country. We ought to aspire to be a comfortable, economically sound country. We can do that, and that's where I think we would like to go.
Mm. At the beginning of Aorahoia, I also asked what you thought of France's treatment of domestic violence cases during this pandemic. On a similar note, what is your advice to people who are on their own while their struggle with mental health has become really severe? Is it possible for them to move somewhere that has more support while we're still in level four?
Yes, and of course they should do for their own sake. I think for somebody on their own who is really feeling the effects and it's affecting their mental health, providing they're physically healthy and providing they can find a place to go to, another bubble, if you like, to go to where everybody is physically healthy, no one has had coronavirus or suspected of it or been tested for it, then actually they should do. They should mix those bubbles. And actually that's what would be able to happen under level three. But even under level four, people's health, including the mental health, is top priority and people got to look after that. So approaching that sensibly and in a way that doesn't expose someone to the risk of infection of this virus, if they can do that in a way and the result of that is going to be to improve their mental health, then they should do it.
Excellent. It's good to hear you confirm that. Let's finish on a lighthearted note today. I noticed that you made a post as part of the Me at 20 tag. Where was that photo taken and why did you have the theatre symbol on your jersey?
I don't know. The photo was on the web somewhere. I still can't figure out where it was taken. I'm pretty sure it was my third year at university. The sweat top that I had was... when I was a teenager living in New Plymouth, one of the things I did was youth theatre and we got sweat tops. I didn't do any drama or theatre after I left New Plymouth. Once I went to university, I sort of got involved in other things. But
that was Labour MP Andrew Little.
The Wire.
That was Labour MP Andrew Little, and who knew? He was in theatre in New Plymouth. Oh. Text in 5395 if you have any thoughts on that. Also, any questions for the minister that we can put to him next week. Speaking of Australia, though.
You call that a news update? This is a news update. It's Neighbourhood Watch.
This week in Neighbourhood Watch, Zoe updates Mary Margaret on what Adelaide looks like at the moment compared to the rest of the continent. They also discuss what's happened to one of the country's key airlines, how worried people really are about the latest Malcolm Turnbull and Scott Morrison controversy, and an exciting kangaroo sighting.
Let's start generally. April's coming to a close. How is Adelaide looking?
Yeah, not too bad. We had a bit of a hat trick recently. I think it was three states in one day had reported no new cases of coronavirus. So it was us, WA and the ACT, I believe. We've had a few days where we haven't had any new cases. Unfortunately, that did change yesterday with two new cases. So we're doing pretty well. South Australians, Adelaideans, are really taking it very seriously. The curve is flattening. In Australia as a whole, the most hot topic is this kind of tracing app. If you go to your workplace, they can tell you that there has been a reported case, someone else in that workplace. But it obviously brought up a lot of conversations about privacy and the information right. The government will have access to. A couple of weird things. Bondi Beach is somewhat reopening on Monday. They're opening it up to surfing, but no one's allowed to be walking, running or sunbathing in the area. That is the decision of the local council. I woke up to that news today. I haven't probably really processed it properly. I don't think it's right, but, they're doing it.
There's been a lot of debate over here sort of comparing us to Australia, saying that our lockdown wasn't necessary in terms of its stringence, given that you guys didn't have as serious a lockdown and have managed to flatten the curve.
Okay. Well, that's really interesting. If I could put my two cents in as an Australian, like I had incredible envy over your country and your government's tackling of the situation as quickly as they could. We talked a bit about it in the earlier weeks of just that comfort that we really lacked in Australia. Everything was so uncertain. We didn't know. Everyone was just losing jobs. No one, everyone was still walking around. That was an awful feeling.
Right. Yeah. It's interesting to get your perspective in that discussion. Moving on though. So Virgin Airlines has been forced into voluntary administration. What does this mean?
Yeah. So it's not necessarily a death sentence. It does mean that they have to sort of hand over who it's being run by. They're sort of planning to pay off debts. They're needing to make big decisions, but it doesn't necessarily mean the company is going completely bankrupt or shutting down. It does mean that 15,000 employees don't know the certainties of their job in the coming months. It's sort of run by the founder, Richard Branson, as a bit of a figurehead. So it comes under his little umbrella of companies. And he's said that it, you know, will be back up and running despite this voluntary administration. But then other people are saying that Virgin Airlines will be needing to make some serious decisions. And what led to this was that the government kind of rejected a bailout. This is quite significant. In Australia, we really just have Qantas and Virgin. So in terms of a consumer and the general population, the issue is that there's no guarantee if you have credit for Virgin Airlines that you will ever get that back. And it also means that in the future, if Virgin Airlines were to completely shut down, Qantas will be the big guns. And that means that airfares and travelling, you know, could be more expensive if there's no other competition in the country for the general consumer.
Right.
I think there'll be a lot of push from unions, consumer advocacy groups, the general public, to make sure, yeah, there isn't, that Qantas don't get a big head, so to speak, and air prices really do go up. But I think over 15,000 Virgin Australia employees who would potentially be getting left behind by the government if they weren't to do anything, that also indicates to me that perhaps they will, and that this is probably not the end of the story.
Another story that you told me had been going on over there is that Malcolm Turnbull was set to release his memoirs, and allegedly an advisor to Scott Morrison pirated them.
It's called A Bigger Picture. A senior advisor somehow got hold of it. Apparently he was sent the copy unsolicited, and then he pirated it out, and then all these people had this copy of this memoir of Turnbull. But now it's turned a bit more serious because of plagiarism and copyright, and his senior advisor has been found out, and they are going through some legal proceedings that the Prime Minister's office isn't commenting on. I would not have thought twice about Malcolm Turnbull's book. It's, you know, now everyone's talking about it, and I don't know, it probably will sell a few more copies this way.
I was going to ask that, you know, at the moment, I didn't know how much people would really care about the release of those memoirs. Has it led to any sort of drop in Scott Morrison's polling or any more substantial criticism of the way his administration is run?
Not necessarily. I think, you know, that whole we're in a crisis, you will see the current government gain a bit more popularity or trust, or they kind of become the preferred during this heightened time of emergency. So it hasn't really done too much damage, I'd say, than as much as perhaps maybe Turnbull was hoping.
Yeah. I thought we'd finish on a lovely little story. I saw that just a little video of a kangaroo sprinting down the one of the main roads in Adelaide CBD.
You saw that?
Yeah.
I live really close to that footage where I live like a 5-minute walk from there. And I was pissed because I went for a bike ride on Sunday morning. I usually do, and I have been more because it's so quiet on the roads. And I usually go around the CBD instead of to like the beach or the hills or whatever. But on Sunday morning, I went to the beach. So I went the other way and I probably might have seen a kangaroo. And I'm so glad that I missed it. But it's really cute, this little kangaroo. And I mean, Adelaide City is quite small anyway. That kangaroo probably did cover our entire CBD. It's amazing. It was so cute, the little footage of them like hopping around and having a good time. I had never seen that before in my life. But we haven't seen much much more of little stories from around of creatures coming out in unusual places. But I hope there's maybe more.
Yeah.
I'm taking my bike around the CBD every Sunday morning.
That was Neighbourhood Watch. Ripper.
It was Neighbourhood Watch with Zoe Kunatis, and we'll hear again from her next week. Now moving to another continent.
I am officially running for President of the United States.
Primary consultant is myself because I have a very good brain and I've said a lot of things.
When you're a star, they let you do it. You can do anything.
I like China. You can win against China if you're smart.
So don't tell me about China. I know China.
China! I beat the people from China. What the hell is going on?
It's time for State of the States.
Oh, I don't know. Today, Rachel was giving us an update on oil prices in the US.
This week, for the first time in history, the price of oil futures went into the negatives. Optimists hope this was a technical and isolated blip. Today, the prices are back up in the positives, and US President Donald Trump is acting as if the negative price was more of a fluke than something more profound.
Based on the record low price of oil that you've been seeing, it's at a level that's very interesting to a lot of people. We're filling up our national petroleum reserves, strategic reserves, and we're looking to put as much as 75 million barrels into the reserves themselves. That would top it out. That would be first time in a long time it's been topped out. We'd get it for the right price.
U.S. crude futures today went below zero, went into negative territory.
Went negative.
Yeah.
Like interest rates, they go negative.
Does that make you want to see Saudi Arabia and Russia and OPEC Plus do more to reduce supply?
Much of it has to do with short sellers. Much of it has to do, if you look a month into the future, I think it's at $25 or $28 a barrel. So a lot of people got caught. They got caught, and there are a lot of people that are not too happy because they got caught. So if you take a look at it, you'll see it's more of a financial thing than an oil situation.
So, how can a price be in the negatives? The global economy has been under pressure for some time, but at this point, due to lockdowns and travel bans, we simply do not need the amount of oil we are producing. On Monday, the benchmark price for US oil, the West Texas Intermediate Contract, plunged to minus $40 a barrel. The way oil is traded is very precarious. Buyers and sellers are under a contract where they agree to trade at a predetermined price at a predetermined time in the future. This is known in the economics world as oil futures. Since traders were worried that they could not possibly store the crude oil they were obligated to take possession of, they began to frantically dump their contracts, sending prices off the charts. This means traders were willing to effectively pay buyers tens of thousands of dollars a contract to take oil off their hands. Experts have been warning for some time that we would soon run out of space to put all the oil. That time has come. The crashing oil markets has highlighted the powerlessness of Trump. His reaction to the crash was to pressure Saudi Arabia and Russia to stop the oil price war and strike a deal to produce less oil and stabilize oil markets. But even that historic curb is not enough to counter the blow that COVID-19 has caused. It is becoming clear that what we are dealing with is a precarious industry, neither economically nor environmentally sustainable. But at the end of the day, the continuing supply of oil is vital to American society. To explain this, here are two oil sector experts, Bob Kavner, former CEO of Malago Exploration, and Cornelia Meyer, CEO of Meyer Resource.
So you're saying that in a lot of ways the industry was already in trouble before something like this happened?
We tend to do this to ourselves. We over-lever, we drill a lot, we develop new technologies that allow us to drill wells at lower cost, which increases production. In fact, it increases production so much, we changed the laws in the states a few years ago to allow U.S. companies to export U.S.-produced crude, which was against the law up until about two or three years ago. Mm-hmm. And so now we've developed our own export market, producing more and more crude, importing less from the Middle East and Canada and other places. But we've continued to increase supply even as conservation and slowdowns in the economy in 2009 and 2015 have slowed the growth, the demand itself. And so we've created this problem over a period of time, and now we're to the point where we're over-levered, overproduced, and now with these low prices in serious crisis.
Cornelia, I saw you nodding. You have some thoughts on what Bob was saying about how, in some ways, the industry sometimes does it to itself.
Oh, yeah, we are classic boom to bust to boom industry. We do that all the time.
But what does this mean for people actually working in the oil industry? A bust in industry doesn't just affect corporations and shareholders. As of March this year, 156,000 people are employed in the US oil and gas sector, all of whom could be unemployed if the sector goes under. If firms go bust, tax revenue that funds government programs will be lost as well. There are so many more jobs surrounding oil production and distribution that the damage will be incredibly widespread.
Excuse me, I'm really rich.
That was State of the States.
Bye-bye.
How stupid is this?
Moving right along.
Your daily epidemic response committee update on 95BFM.
Today we have James and Connor writing for us, and in today's Epidemic Response Committee we have seen a focus on the future of business and entrepreneurship in New Zealand with the need to develop contact tracing technology as a leading nation on a global scale and to plan for an economic reset. Due to the nature of such a large event, there is a huge call to recenter the economy as it is an event which will not happen. Due to an environmental focus of New Zealand, it's seen as the uttermost importance to move to a renewable ways of production and the incorporation of renewable energy into all walks of life. Today we heard from Rod Drury, a technology entrepreneur and the founder and former CEO of Xero, Tracy Hopapa, member of MNZM and Māori business leader, Ian Proudfoot, global head of agribusiness at KPMG. The committee started off talking to Rod Drury, particularly around the development of contact tracing and the technology being developed with the ability for New Zealand to be at the forefront. And while there has been a push for a while, Drury says we will need to increase the use of contactless payment and that technology which comes with that is key. From his point of view, we will be successful if there is effective cooperation between the public and private sectors, with one company leading the project and the collaboration with 5 to 10 other companies. This, however, would require stronger talks with banks to lower the 3% surcharge on businesses so the technology can be adopted without a large hit to the bottom line. While this is technology which will hopefully be used once we're at level 2, there has been serious scrutiny of the reach of technology across New Zealand currently. Drury made the point that the push for 5G will be a large jump but will be hugely beneficial in pushing our ability to operate on a global scale. He also pointed out fibre still isn't widespread, with the reach to rural areas still on a small scale, particularly places such as lifestyle blocks. This was reiterated by Tracy Hopapa, with the lack of internet connection in rural areas which makes it harder to maintain business in the modern world, as well as connectivity. Another area where Drury says needs a push is the development of hydro energy to make it as important to use as oil is to Saudi Arabia. If we get to 100% renewable electricity, this will have an added value to all our products on an international scale, particularly high value and sustainable products such as electric cars. After Rod Drury, we heard from Tracy Hopapa, a leader in the business world space for women and the Māori community. Hopapa built on a lot of the points Rod made around connectivity for rural communities and what role this place is in Māori business, as well as the importance of the environment to our economy. Hopapa also pointed out the importance of Māori to the New Zealand economy needs to be pushed forward in this economic reset due to the role they place in society in supporting the economy and providing culture. The importance of women in society also was brought to the table with recognition of an increase in domestic violence due to COVID-19, as well as the extra pressure single mothers will be facing during these times. We then heard from KPMG Global Head of Agribusiness, Ian Proudfoot, who says the agri-food business is committed to finding ways to accelerate the industry back to a productive and profitable position. Proudfoot pointed out water storage is a priority, which means water supply needs to remain constant for domestic usage and export. He also brought up that rising unemployment and lower spending means the industry needs to rethink how it distributes domestically produced food in these economic conditions. As well as this, New Zealand is exploring gene editing in order to keep the food supply constant. China is a big concern. They are New Zealand's biggest export market for food, and reduced spending by Chinese consumers could hurt New Zealand badly. Exploration of digital channels is being explored as a way to tap into other markets in order to supplement the loss. Proudfoot says digital ordering also means a more direct relationship with consumers anywhere in the world. Next on the agenda was that growing protectionism around the world is equally a big concern, and if trade barriers are implemented too much, government assistance over the long term may be needed. This means bringing visitors to New Zealand again is key to reinvigorating interest in New Zealand agri-food products and reviving small-scale food production operations, something which is hugely important as food export will be the industry that leads New Zealand's economic recovery. The biggest trend coming is a move from monocultural farming. This means farms need to diversify into other areas like horticulture and forestry. Farmers will need to reskill very rapidly to keep up with market conditions and demands. Currently, New Zealand can only feed 40 million people, meaning New Zealand has a limited potential market. However, moving fast to prepare, New Zealand will keep that sector secure. Globally, regulators follow the consumers, and it's up to the agri-food sector to be aware of consumers' environmental expectations, i.e. around production methods. Gene editing is different to GMO food. Gene editing is key to maintaining the food supply, and preventing shortages. Water storage concerns are directly related to climate change, for example, unforeseen droughts in the Waikato. New Zealand needs to prepare and become familiar with our changing climates and respond to that. Green assets need investment to maintain food and water security in a way that is constantly consulting with farmers in the private sector. New Zealand's commitment to zero carbon transition is the strongest in the world. However, these commitments need to be enacted in a way that keeps New Zealand's agri-food industry secure and or growing, i.e. an increase in the grass-fed meat. Agri-food marketing is key for New Zealand, considering we're a new market and a small market in an industry of high global competition. Grey water irrigation is something that needs to be considered a lot more. Same with grey water recycling at home. Agri-food sectors could be a great solution to unemployment if a depression comes along and joblessness spikes. That is our notes for now as that committee continues. We'll finish that up. Thank you, James and Connor.
That was your EDC update on 95 BFM.
And actually, on breaking news, Minister Chris Farfoy has made a big announcement today regarding the media. So Broadcasting Minister Chris Farfoy has just announced a $50 million package for the media sector. It's only the first of two media support packages and is focused on only short-term aid. Minister Farfoy acknowledged that media in Aotearoa was facing challenges way before COVID-19 and said this package was drafted in consultation with members of the media sector. The key part of the package is $21.1 million for funding the broadcasting of TV and FM medias for 6 months, as opposed to media entities paying for transmission themselves. We will hear more about that later this afternoon. Let's move into our final piece for today. Tamati Kruger is the chair of Te Uruwera Board and chair of the Tūhoe Tribal Office, Te Uru Taumatua. When the original Level 4 lockdown was announced, Tūhoe announced closures of freedom camping areas in the region. Since then, they've also set up some checkpoints. A number of iwi throughout the Motu have set up their own checkpoints as a way of reducing the possibility of the virus being brought into those areas. There has been varied responses to these, and they are indeed operating in a varied nature. Tūhoe have since announced that in the shift to Level 3, much of their Level 4 restrictions in place will remain the same. This is because the risk of a devastating outbreak in their community remains high due to the access to healthcare in the area, as well as pre-existing conditions that disproportionately affect the Māori. I asked Tamati if we could have a chat about some of these issues and started by asking how his rāhui period has been at home.
We're we're tolerating each other. We now know all of our first names. My washing up times come around really, really quickly. I now volunteer to mow my own lawns, so I'll have something to do. But otherwise, no, my whānau is really good. I live at Taneatua, and I take a walk around the town most mornings, and generally it feels as if people understand and are committed to level four behaviours. I think the most difficult thing is keeping the 2 metre distance, you know, being all related. We do more of a kind of a 1 foot kind of social distancing. But other than that, there is a general respect and understanding for all of the changes that have to take place. And like everywhere else in the country, it's understandably difficult. And people are worried about the future, I think, and the changes that take place. But immediately within the tūhoerohe, there is no worry about food supply around getting assistance and help if necessary.
And in terms of, I guess, that supplies even and people having what they need, has that been okay as far as, you know, to your knowledge?
Yeah, very, very quickly okay. I think being very rural, from an Auckland point of view, really isolated, but from our view, very normal, there is an inbuilt behavior of being self-reliant and doing what you can for yourself. You know, you live in places like Ruatahuna and Waikare Moana and Matahi Waimana, knowing that there is not a hospital nearby, there is not a GP nearby, so you live with that. And you then have a lifestyle and a behaviours that say to yourself you have to do things for yourself more. So not a worry at all with food supply.
So going back to that initial, when the government announced the level 4 lockdown or rāhui, in terms of making that shift, what did that look like for Te Uruwera? What was that when level 4 kicked in?
Well, we chanced ourselves finding out whether we were a good iwi or not so much a good iwi. An iwi is a kinship organisation that prides itself with being there ready to assist and help everyone in that community. We were, I think, being challenged by how much of the last 200 years we have been colonized and now very dependent on the crown for everything. So when level 4 came around, we were testing our organization, our infrastructure, our connectivity, and our willingness to be there for each other. And things like COVID-19 are really, really good trialing and testing stations for that. And I have to say that we've come out pretty well. We had a bit of an awkward, rusty start in the first 2 weeks, but quickly people came forward volunteering, taking responsibility for a whole lot of stuff. And so generally now, Rohe, people are feeling that their iwi has been a great advantage and a great inspiration to them.
In that kind of shift, I suppose, and again, throughout those 4 weeks, my understanding is initially there weren't any sort of what's being called checkpoints set up,
yes.
but there have been some set up since then. So what are those looking like?
We avoided Googling it, and we avoided imitating what other people were doing. The first thing we did was we had a discussions amongst our tribal community leaders to make sure that if we were to do checkpoints, we understood very clearly what their purpose was and if they were going to produce any efficiencies in stemming the spread of the virus. And thirdly, did we have the capacity to be able to undertake that with people that we could trust would be sending the right messages? Then out of that discussion, we then got an overall support for it from our tribal communities. Then we corresponded with the police just to check out the legality of it and the general do's and don'ts, getting the wording right, getting the behavior right, getting the information right when you are stopping road users, and we can understand it's quite intimidating. And once we got that all sorted out, then we put that into place. Yeah. Mm. So people are, I think, in our roche anyway, we decided on four checkpoints, one in Waimana, Ruatoki, Ruatahun, and Waikaremoana. And it was clearly in support of the containment strategy, self-isolation, the distancing, and around about the good health of everyone.
And I guess what would you say to the sort of public backlash there has been to these checkpoints, not necessarily individualising any of them, but also, again, not speaking generally, because there are different ones operating differently throughout the motu, but generally that sort of attitude that is put out there that, you know, these are illegal and people kind of operating to their own standards or their own laws within their own rohe, te mea te mea, what, putting that into the spotlight saying, oh, that's not allowed?
Well, I don't know how they have operated outside of the Te Uruwera rohe, but I can say that we were very, very careful and prudent in visualising what that would be all about for ourselves. There was, of course, that awkward starting it off because it was all new thing, but we've largely had praise from commuters who were very, very cooperative and understanding of what we were doing. And the other thing is it has helped to limit the unnecessary travel of our own people. So we found that those that were breaching the rules were our own people. And so our own people seeing our own checkpoints became a very, very effective way of rebalancing everything. So we have been very careful about being polite at these road checks, being very clear and exact around our messages, and telling people we're not about enforcement. We're not the police. We're not NZTA. We're not claiming we own the road. all of those things. Because immediately when people are intimidated, they go straight there. They ask what authorities do you have, etc. So yeah.
But I guess you spoke to earlier around that responsibility you have to your iwi. So a lot of what you guys have spoken about when making these decisions is that disproportionate effect that could occur to Māori. So in terms of inequity, I suppose you should say, and inequitable health outcomes, while there hasn't been a sort of wide infection in Māori communities, the possibility of that could be devastating. So there's almost a sort of responsibility to ensure that on another level, right, than what the government is bringing to the table, because there has been Māori scholars who have pointed out that a lot of what the government Solomon is bringing is a kind of one size fits all in some ways. So where is that kind of, that there is almost like a need perhaps for certain groups to be operating in a way which cares for the specific needs of that group?
Mm-hmm. Well, everything you say is makes sense to us. The first thing that Tuhui considered was, were the announcements made by the Prime Minister and the government, were they generally acceptable to us? Did they ring with a tone of caring for everyone generally? And immediately our response was yes. So we supported both the level three and the move to level four for the reasons that were stated. After that point, we charged ourselves with being responsible for the enacting of that and any other standard within Aorohe. We gave ourselves that responsibility to do that. We did not wait around for somebody to ring us up and authorize us. We didn't think that that was going to ever be the case. Why did we do that? Because we are the best at dealing with our own people. Nobody knows anything more than ourselves as to how to influence our own people within our own community. Secondly, we believe that this is our duty and our job to serve our people. The government certainly has some duties, but on the ground within Te Uruwera, they will never ever be as effective as we are. So already then there was a basis of cooperation, collaboration, and agreement with the reasons for level four. We operated on that basis and then applied our translations of that on the ground. And that has worked out. I do not know yet of an issue where we are at difference with the government.
Is there anything else you would like to add?
Possibly that this whole change for all of us has accentuated thoughts and revision of what family and home means, and that has been really good, that we've been all given time to reevaluate what home and family is and also the connection between health and nature and our connection with our environment, that I think that has emerged as well for many, many, if not most people, and an assessment of our lifestyle, as people call it the economy, but it's really lifestyle. And these are wonderful things to be put in a place where we have to reconsider our principles and our values and our lifestyle. And as we, in the next month or so, study our livelihood and the sustainability of our lifestyles.
That was Tamati Kruger there.
That was The Wire.
And yes, that was The Wire for Thursday, 23rd of April. End of the show. What a big show. We are well over time. I'm sure you've all tuned out to go watch Dr. Ashley Bloomfield, but that's fine. I don't mind. On the show today, we had Andrew Little and Zoe Kunatis as usual. Also, a big thank you to Kate Hannah and Tamati Kruger there. Thank you to James Tapp and Connor Nell for the Epidemic Response Committee notes. Big shout out to my producers, Mary Margaret and Rachel, doing this all from home. What a tough time. Some audio quality issues there that you guys can probably hear. We're all doing our best. So a big shout out to the news team for that. I'll be back with you tomorrow. And yeah, I guess nobody's listening because Dr. Ashley Bloomfield. I'm just going to go. See you tomorrow.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.